listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers, coming from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Mary Dingy Fillmore, whose new novel is An Address in Amsterdam, published by She Writes Press. Mary Fillmore fell in love with Amsterdam in 2001 and has been returning there and researching its complex history ever since. A longtime professional facilitator for nonprofits and government, she gives talks for the Vermont Humanities Council and others, titled Anne Frank's Neighbors, What Did They Do? Mary earned an MFA at Vermont College of Fine Arts in 2005. An Address in Amsterdam concerns 18-year-old Rachel Klein, who is too busy falling in love to take the Nazis seriously when they invade in May 1940. Rachel's own father thinks it will all blow over, but when her Gentile boyfriend must go underground because of his anti-Nazi activism, Rachel begins to change. She ultimately becomes a courier for the underground, delivering messages, news sheets, and false papers. Her life is in peril, and she must keep her activities secret from everyone. After many months of clandestine activities during intensifying raids, Rachel and her parents go into hiding, moving from an elegant canal house to a dank basement where much is revealed. When I spoke with Mary Dingy Fillmore, I began by asking her to read the preface from An Address in Amsterdam.
Rachel didn't linger in case she was being watched. The canal sloshed uneasily below her. Looking both ways, she slipped close to another house. Was this the address where she was supposed to deliver the envelope? Yes. The white number on the dark blue metal plate corresponded to the one she'd memorized. She knocked three times. The door opened the merest crack with no light behind it. One eye and a slice of a finely lined face. Rachel shrank back like the teenager she'd been before the Nazi occupation, a polite Jewish doctor's daughter taught to be cautious of strangers. Then she squared her shoulders and steadied her voice, forcing out the prescribed words. Is Uncle Harry here? Yes, came a whisper. Come in. Rachel took a quick breath and entered. Her hands still trembled a little. Deliveries were riskier today than a year ago. She made out the outline of the thin man who'd answered the door. He stepped past her to the threshold and listened, taut and alert. His house must have been raided before. The man stuck his head partway out the door and looked up the slick street. He took one swift step back, then closed the door quickly and quietly. Downstairs, he hissed, grabbing Rachel's hand, yanking her along behind him. Her feet responded before her mind registered his urgency. She sensed rather than saw the looming furniture in the dark hallway. If this address was a trap, what would he do to her? Wait, Rachel said. She stopped short, jerking the man backward for a moment. He might be a collaborator. She'd heard so many stories, and she'd never delivered anything to this address before. He pulled her arm hard enough that she was again forced to stumble along behind him. Shut up, he spat between clenched teeth. She felt tears burning under her eyelids. She lurched along, fearing that he might dislocate her shoulder. He halted abruptly near the back of the house. A latch clinked as he shoved a door open. Downstairs, he commanded, pushing her ahead of him. The steps squeaked under her uncertain feet. In the darkness at the bottom, the ceiling was shorter than she was, so she hunched over, breathing in dank air. The door closed above her. She heard the man's steps shuffle softly, then felt his hands on her shoulders, steering her. He switched on a flashlight. Go left, about 2 meters. He moved in front of her, and they crept along. When he stopped in front of a large storage wardrobe, he pressed his lips against the crack between the door and the frame to speak. She could hear the sound of his voice, but not the words. A weak answer came from inside as the door creaked open. How could someone breathe in there? So many people were crammed into attics and basements all over the city. At first, almost no one had taken the Nazis seriously. Like them, Rachel had believed that the Netherlands would protect all of its citizens, Jews as well as Gentiles. It had been a sanctuary for the 3 centuries since her mother's family had fled the Spanish in the 1600s. But everything had changed incalculably since the German Nazis swarmed over the Dutch border in 1940. Although only 2.5 years had passed, the era before the invasion felt as distant as her early childhood. "Get in," the man ordered. She began to step inside, but drew back when she heard a soft cry. "Be careful," someone whispered. "There are 6 of us in here already." The thin man nudged Rachel forward, her face toward the wardrobe's back wall. "What's going on?" It was another irritated voice, a man's. When the door shut, Rachel's ribs compressed so it was hard to breathe. The thin man must have stepped in backward to close the door, because his back was jammed against her spine. Since the wardrobe was a little shorter than Rachel, she had to slouch lower. Quick breaths pumped her ribs against his back. She felt her golden brown curls stick to the back of her neck. In front of her was the rounded form of another woman, pressing against Rachel's bony frame. "What's happening?" A man's whisper from a back corner. The thin man said, "5 German green police. I saw them turn this way. They might have seen me, or this girl might have led them to us." A sudden stillness fell. No one could step away from her, but everyone who was touching her stiffened. "You're crazy," Rachel said. "Anyway, how do I know who you are?" "Sure. We're pretending we have to hide. That's why we've been locked up here for days." She heard a sneer in the man's voice, then low mutterings from others. They might strangle her here in these stifling quarters if they thought she was on the other side. She'd have to risk telling them the truth. "I work for the underground. I've brought your papers." She must not lose control of her voice. The silence this time had changed as the unseen group recalculated. "Sorry," a man whispered from the corner. "Shh," from the thin man. From the front of the house came one crack, then 3 others. The wooden door finally splintered. Some instinct made Rachel reach for the other woman's hand and clutch it. Heavy, booted footsteps stomped overhead. The air inside the wardrobe soured. Shouting, then clomping feet up to the 2nd floor. A collective exhale in the closet as they realized the boots were not yet headed downstairs. Sweat stuck skin to skin. After all the risks Rachel had taken in the months she'd worked for the underground, wouldn't it be ironic to be captured here in a normal house-to-house raid? She'd carried coded messages, distributed illegal mimeographed newspapers, and, since she'd moved into even more dangerous work, delivered false identity papers. It had been hard to follow the orders never to tell her parents what she was doing, but now Rachel felt the rightness of that choice. If the Nazis came to the door to say she'd been arrested, her mother and father would say, "Not Rachel, not our daughter. You must have the wrong address." And they would know nothing, no matter what the police did to them.
Thank you for reading that. That's wonderful. It's a really riveting preface, and it's a bit of a long piece to read at the beginning of the interview, but I like that preface so much, I really wanted you to read that. I want to actually start by talking about the first sentence of the prologue, if we can. The first sentence, or the preface, is, "Rachel didn't linger in case she was being watched." It's such a great opening. We're right there. There's a real immediacy to it, and then we're also given some sense of the storyline just in that very brief sentence. So I wonder if you can talk about openings and what you like to see in an opening.
Surely. I think something that is vivid for the reader is extremely important at that moment, especially because at that moment we don't yet know anything about her.
Right.
You know, Rachel could be anybody, anywhere. And so having a characteristic moment for that person in their life situation that's very easy for the reader to imagine and put themselves there was what I was trying to achieve.
Right, and we can all relate to fear.
Yes.
We can all relate to the, you know, the instinct to hide or to flee. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the book begins after the Dutch surrender in 1940 when the Nazis occupied Amsterdam. That preface actually is in 1942, but then we move back in time a couple years. So how did you come to be interested in this period in history, Mary?
It was really the place that captivated me first. I had an opportunity in 2001 to spend 6 months in Amsterdam.
Okay.
And almost immediately after I arrived, I'd been there as a tourist, but I'd never been there for a long time. And almost immediately, I was recaptured and fell in love again with the canals and the architecture, which I knew a little more about by the time I saw it, you know, in my early 50s rather than in my 20s and 30s.
Right.
So I was able to appreciate it somewhat differently. And I fell in love with the city completely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like all great loves that when you fall for a person or a place that way, you want to know everything about them.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon I began to bump into the stories of the Holocaust and resistance. I had an experience right before I went to Amsterdam that prepared me for this, even though, as an American Gentile, I had been able to avoid the subject of the Holocaust for most of my life. But I had a very dear friend, 23 years older, mm-hmm. Eliane Vogel-Polsky. I went to visit her for a week in Brussels before going to Amsterdam. And even though at that point we'd known each other, I think, for 19 years, she revealed to me for the first time that she had been hidden in plain sight in Belgium.
Wow.
As a Jewish teenager, 15. So this brought it home to me in a very, very different way. Then I arrived in Amsterdam and after a few weeks discovered that I was living inside the Nazi-defined Jewish quarter.
Oh, wow.
So I realized that if we had been there 60 years before, I would have been watching my neighbors be rounded up.
Yeah.
You know, probably my doctor, because many doctors in the city were Jewish. Certainly the person who sold me oranges or vegetables.
Sure.
The kids who I had seen going to school. So that it gave the whole question of what were the circumstances?
Yes.
Not only of the Jewish people, but of the neighbors.
Yeah.
And my interest in the neighbors and what the dilemmas of the neighbors were motivated me as much as wanting to know what happened to the Jewish people themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just mentioned that you're not Jewish, and yet you chose to write a story that's very much about Jewish people. And on one of the pieces of literature that I received with this book was the following quote by René Reindorf,
yes,
a Belgian resistance worker. And the quote is, "The Holocaust is not about the Jews. It is about the rest of humanity." I kept thinking about that after I read it, and I wonder if we could talk a little bit about this idea.
Surely. And if I can fill you in a little bit more about him, he was a colleague in the resistance of Eliane's husband.
Okay.
So I met him maybe 5 years before I went to Amsterdam. So he was somebody.
Remind me what year you went to Amsterdam?
2001.
2001. Okay.
So I met him in his old age, but you know, a man of great charm. And when he said this to me, I was so struck by it,
mm-hmm,
because I think our focus as a culture with the Holocaust is nearly always on the Jews and how terrible it is that they were mass murdered and victimized, mm-hmm, and so forth. And there is so much more to the story than that. When he said the Holocaust isn't just about the Jews, it is about the rest of humanity, I realized that, of course, what we all need to be examining much, much more closely is all of us who colluded, all of us who collaborated,
right?
You know, and the handful who resisted.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that it's not important, because of course I feel it is, which is why I wrote a book primarily focused on that. Of course it's important to understand who the Jewish community of Amsterdam was, what happened to them. But I think we also need to have our eyes on the questions about how this could happen,
yeah,
in what Russell Shorto has a wonderful book called The History of the World's Most Liberal City.
Mm-hmm.
And Amsterdam was that for many years, and it was a sanctuary from the time of the Spanish Inquisition. So what happened that made this possible?
Right.
And it couldn't have happened without the rest of humanity.
Sure.
So that's why that quotation was meaningful to me.
Yeah. Mary, I found your descriptions of place particularly lovely. Do you mind if I just read a really small section?
I'd be delighted.
Okay. This is from Rachel's perspective. As summer's long days shrank, the Westertoren's tall silhouette incised itself against the dark sky, ever earlier, soaring over the houses. Rachel watched the change from her desk overlooking the canal beside her mother's piano. Schoolwork helped her stay sane, especially mathematics and the other sciences. You could learn it, and it was done, not like the less exact subjects in the arts. Sometimes she raised her eyes from her work to gaze past the tall burgundy drapes, to watch the intricate patterns of light and water on the murky canal. When still, it reflected the houses opposite and their subtly carved windowsills and doorways. The elm's leafy branches filtered the intermittent sunshine layer upon layer. Rachel loved looking up from her books and knowing such beauty was still there, despite the ubiquitous German presence. Just that little tiny section, and there were so many sections like that. You really infuse the whole book with this lovely sense of place. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about writing a setting that is foreign to you. I know that you spent time there, but it is not your home. So can you talk about that?
Well, there were a couple of things that I had in my favor with that. One was that I did get to be there 5 times for 6 months.
No,
so,
okay.
So I had a chance really to
Six months each. Wow, a long time.
Six months each.
Okay.
You know, give or take a week. But the thing that made it so possible for me was that while I was there, this is what I was almost entirely dedicating myself to.
Right.
So that I was really watching. I was really spending time sitting there with my notebook, just describing setting after setting after setting. Everything that happens in the book happens at a specific place.
And were you living in a place that you then gave to that family?
Not exactly.
Okay.
Not exactly. I lived in 5 different places.
Okay.
On the 5 different occasions, but I know that place well. And as with any work of literature, some part of what happened in the book was planned by me, and some parts of what happened in the book just appeared. And one of the things that just appeared was the location of their house. And I do have a particular house in mind, and it is a real canal in a specific spot.
Yeah, okay. And I read, I'm trying to remember where I read this, but in preparing for the interview, I read that, in fact, Anne Frank's hiding place was within blocks of the place that you put Rachel's fictional home.
That's correct. That's correct. The attic where the family ends up is a place where we lived.
Yeah.
And it's just along the canal from the Anne Frank house.
Okay.
And there is actually a subtle reference in the book to the Anne Frank house that the truly alert reader may catch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I must not be the truly alert reader.
Well,
I missed it.
I'll show it to you later.
Okay. All right. So we've talked about writing a setting that is foreign to you. This is a slightly different take on the same question, but how about writing about a culture that is foreign to you?
That was more difficult,
yeah.
And I certainly was deliberate in my choice to make Rachel's family a secular Jewish family rather than a religious Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
And because the people who I was closest to in learning about it were Elian,
right,
and then contemporaries of mine whose parents or grandparents had gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was writing something that was closer to the experience I was hearing about most intimately from her. But I also read scads of memoirs, scads and scads of them. There are a lot, because there were so many people who came to a certain moment in life and really wanted to communicate to their children and grandchildren
what had happened.
What had happened. So that's a somewhat rough road in terms of the writing. Some of them are great works, some of them are not so great, but they're all fascinating and revelatory.
Yeah.
And fortunately for me, many of those works were written in English by people who had immigrated to Canada or to Israel, which were the two places where most people went.
Huh. Did you reread Anne Frank's diary?
I deliberately did not.
I wondered if you would deliberately avoid it.
I deliberately did not, because I was afraid to be influenced by it unduly. I remembered it quite vividly from, mm-hmm. I read it when I was a child, then I read it again in my 20s. And I had visited the Anne Frank house both on my first trip to Amsterdam when I was quite young, and then I did go back again several times in the course of my years in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to pick up too much from it.
Okay. You're listening to Write the Book and an interview with the author Mary Dingy Fillmore, whose 2016 novel is An Address in Amsterdam, published by She Writes Press. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you would go to iTunes and rate it, review it, or just pass along the show's information to some friends. Thank you so much, and do keep listening. So at one point, I want to ask a craft question now. When Rachel at one point is feeling very upset about the state of her country, this is quite early in the book actually, you describe a merchant handing her change, and you say that he pressed coins, cold and dead, into her soft palm. I loved that. Mm-hmm. I wondered if we could talk about the personification of objects to reflect mood.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of objects like that in the book,
mm-hmm.
and there are certainly some consistent imagery in the book. I actually was trained as a poet, not as a novelist. Something.
Do you have an MFA
don't...
in poetry?
I do.
Yeah, right.
I do.
Okay.
I do. And so that meant that I was infusing a lot of this book with what I learned as a poet, and certainly making sure that the objects in the book have some significance, that they aren't just themselves. And in a world where so much was changing and in upheaval, when so many things that my heroine, Rachel, would have expected to be stable and constant were not,
right.
The objects, the books, the piano, the music, all of those things, nature, became so much more important.
Sure. And actually, I'm thinking of this scene where her friend's family's house is ransacked, and they own an art gallery, and there are beautiful, beautiful objects in that home that are suddenly going to be taken away from them. And it does. It makes you realize how objects would have such meaning, but maybe not even just the valuable things, but the very sentimental mm-hmm. things. And yeah.
Yes. And then what happens to people when almost all of those objects are taken away?
Right. Right. I wonder how writing this book changed or amplified your understanding of this war. We all know a lot about World War II. We've all read, quite a lot about World War II. So much literature has been written about it. And yet we are continually fascinated by it. So anyway, your own experience of writing the book.
It changed my view completely. I think I had protected myself from learning more about the Holocaust.
Mm.
I thought it was a simple story and that it was a good and evil story. One of the first things that hooked me in a way that made me want to go more deeply into it was a visit that I made to the Jewish History Museum within my first few weeks of arriving in 2001.
Okay.
And 98% of that museum is about the accomplishments of the Jewish community over time, about which I could talk for quite a while. But 2% of it was about the 1940 to 45 time. And one of the photographs in it that really haunted me was of two little children, maybe they're 7 and 10, something like that, a sister and brother, as it turns out. And they are just grinning, you know, ear to ear, happy as can be, and they're wearing the star.
Mm.
And that was a moment when I thought, wait, there's much more here than I've ever understood.
Yeah.
And I was also very captivated by the idea that even a tiny handful of people resisted.
Yeah.
And the question I had was, where did they find their courage?
Yes.
And how did they sustain themselves, for those who lived to sustain themselves, how did they sustain themselves as they saw their friends and neighbors being arrested, often tortured, executed, deported, who knew in some cases what happened? How did they keep going?
Right.
And I think there was also some way in which I had entered the city at such a deep level for myself as a contemporary person that I wanted to know who I would have been had I been there.
Yes, right. When you say, you know, who even knows what happened to some of them, I remember a line in the book that you said that Hitler had very specifically said that some people should be taken into the, what was it, darkness
and
mist?
Night and fog.
Right. And that was his way of saying that their families would never know what happened to them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Talking about bravery or talking about where they found their courage, there's a wonderful scene where there's a terrifying scene in a marketplace where the Nazis come in and they detain dozens of men. They first of all make them squat in an uncomfortable position. They ridicule them if they fall over and can't hold their balance. Eventually, they detain them and take them away. And Rachel feels great shame after not taking action and not being able to do anything. This was an extremely moving moment and a pivotal moment in the plot of the book, I think. I found her fear and her shame very real. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this scene and also just sort of the research that you did learning about acts of bravery and the shame around not being able to do more.
Mm-hmm. Let me first just say that that is a recreation of something that really happened.
Okay.
That was the first roundup, and it was actually 425 Jewish men who were detained in that moment. Or that day and the day before. It happened over a 2-day period. But one other detail is that they actually took up the bridges around
right.
the area so that it was isolated.
Right.
So that was another factor.
Yes.
But that feeling of wanting to do something but not knowing what to do or how to do and seeing what happened when there was, remember that little child who starts to scream and cry out?
It, yes.
You know, even she was at risk in this situation. And, you know, there were all of the Jewish boxers there. The boxing clubs for self-defense had been spreading quite successfully.
Right.
So that there were a lot of people, men there with physical training, and even they were not able to take action in this situation
right.
because of the numbers, the guns, all those other factors. And I think that moment of powerlessness and both the rage and the shame that she feels really help impel her they shift her from where she is in that scene, which is a witness
right.
to history. But a few days later, when the only general strike in Western Europe to protest the first roundup of Jewish people happens on February 25th, she then becomes a protester.
Yeah.
No,
right.
And that's where she makes the connection that ultimately leads her into the underground.
I thought it was interesting that you created her character. You gave her a pair of loving parents who have different points of view about what's happening. The mother, Rose, is very concerned. She would like to see the family leave, go somewhere where they can be safe. And the father, it's very interesting. I really did empathize with him because I think that we all have a certain level of denial. And he's got a very comfortable life. He doesn't want to leave his practice. He's a doctor. He doesn't want to leave his comfortable home. And so he allows his denial to take the larger perspective in his mind. And that, I think, sets up Rachel to be it's perfect. You know, she's this character who she does end up helping the resistance, but she does it in the shadows and in secrecy. And it's like she's got these two influences that are very well drawn, I thought. So,
thank you. Two other factors with her father. One is that he's a very dedicated doctor.
Yes.
So he does not want to abandon his patients.
That's
true. And that's a primary.
Right. It's not just about his own comfort.
It's not just that he's comfortable. Right. It's also that he wants to. And he also originally came from Germany. And he can't believe
that they're going to be doing this.
That they're going to be doing this, or that the Dutch will allow it.
Yeah.
So it's really both. And it's interesting, as people have responded to the book, a lot of people have asked me about that and have said, you know, how could he be this way?
Right.
But in fact, that was a very common reaction.
Yeah. Did you have any trouble relating to him as you wrote the book? Were there times where his character...
I mean, I got exasperated with him at times, but I didn't have trouble relating to him. I think of us right now. You know, if somebody called me up and said, "Hi, you really need to go into hiding. Burlington, Vermont isn't safe for you anymore," I would say, "Are you crazy?"
Right.
No,
right.
It's not going to happen to me.
Right.
Donald Trump may register the Muslims. You know, he may raid the nearby neighborhood for illegal immigrants, but he's not going to come after me.
Right.
And that's the position that Jakob was in.
Yes, Jakob is her
comfortable,
father.
Comfortable, the father, comfortable, middle-class physician.
Established.
Nothing could happen to him.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's interesting that you just said that, because my next question is, are any of the people who read this book reacting by drawing parallels to our present moment in history? And I certainly did as I was reading it. I found it it's an incredible time in our history where many people are shocked at the outcome of the election. Many people aren't shocked, and many people are very supportive of Donald Trump. So, you know, there's this tension within our country. And I think that that's got a lot of parallels. Have you been thinking a lot about that with your book tour?
Of course. And people have been asking questions about it as well. I want to mention, as I respond to that, I want to mention that there were so many different ways for people to be active in the underground.
Right.
And I think that's still true today. No, even though we don't have an underground in the same sense that they did, although we may have to develop one, who knows. But there were the forgers.
Right.
Now, those were people who were artists who then turned their talents to forgery. There's one very important character who does that.
And forging documents for escape.
Yes, or ration
false identity,
coupons, false identity, all of that.
Right.
There were also the people who were listening to the BBC at night, which was illegal, transcribing it, getting it onto mimeographed news sheets, which then couriers or messengers like Rachel delivered.
Would deliver.
And there were even, one main character is an assassin whose job it is to kill enemies of the resistance. A little sidelight is that although my character is male, the best known of such people was actually a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what was her name?
Okay, this is a good test of my Dutch pronunciation. It was Honey, and her last name is S-C-H-A-F-T, Schaft.
Honey
is as close
Schaft.
As I can come.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The girl with the red hair was her moniker, if you will. So I point that out just to say that then as now, there were an awful lot of different ways to be active or to collude and even collaborate. And actually, if you recall, there is, we don't see the collaborator face to face, but he's the brother of a very important character in the book. So then as now, there's this wide range. But I think part of my hope for the book is that the portrait that I give of the city of Amsterdam at a particular moment will sober people, because it shows how quickly a civilized society can deteriorate. One of the things that's been alarming me in the last few weeks is the way there's been an escalation in incidents of racist violence, violence against different people, however they may be different, because that kind of unofficial, informal violence was exactly what began in Amsterdam.
Right.
And immediately after the Nazis invaded, it was not the Germans. The Germans were actually very well behaved in that first period between May of 1940 and February of 1941. It was the locals who were active in beating people up, you know, smashing windows, writing nasty anti-Semitic slogans and so forth. And the path that begins with registration is one that's very well known. So part of what I was trying to do was not only tell the story of the city and what happened in the city, but also through this character, Rachel Klein, who begins the book as a bright but pretty ordinary, that is, she's an interesting person, but she's not in any sense a superheroine.
And you spend some time developing her as a young woman who's, you know, got new feelings about her sexuality, and she's falling in love, and she's all worried about that relationship. She's very much a normal girl, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And part of what I'm hoping is that people will look at that rather ordinary teenager and see her making her transitions from that person to witness, then from witness to protest, and then from protest to action. And that she doesn't do this because she's braver than everybody else or because she's this exalted person who, of course, is going to do the noble and right thing. She's just an ordinary person who chooses to do the right thing over and over again, even when she's tired and even when she's scared, which she is most of the time, quite rightly.
Yeah. I like to ask people who've written novels or nonfiction that have historical significance, if you have any research sources that you discovered that were a kind of pleasant surprise that might be helpful to listeners who are doing research, too.
I think for me, it was important both to look at the classic works, the classic books, and I spent a lot of time in libraries and archives and so on. Both here and there, because there's a lot of material in Washington at the Holocaust Museum and also at the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. They have a great deal of Dutch material. But for me, I think one of the most important sources was the photographs. And I didn't expect that particularly. Yet, I found that when I sat with the photographs, and I spent a lot of hours just describing the photographs, that is, writing and describing the photographs, things like the clothing, that you, but also the body language, how people were relating to each other or not. It's complicated by the fact that everything but official photography was illegal during this period. And so what you see is either, it's done on the sly often, and that makes it more interesting in a way. And it also was photographs. Photographs hooked me, I would say, that seeing a photograph of the first canal that we lived on, where we you know, it was at that time still fairly ratty. It's since been gentrified somewhat, but it was one of the oldest canals in the city. And there's a monumental building at one end of it that looks like a fairy tale castle with turrets and so on. It's the old Way House, which actually has in the upper story the Anatomy Theater where Rembrandt painted the anatomy lesson. So it's a magnificent building, the fulfillment of any fantasy one might ever have about such a place. And when I saw a photograph of that building with a 10-foot-high barbed wire fence showing where the Nazis had identified the Jewish quarter right along our canal, that really hit me very hard.
Yeah.
And then I later saw a photograph of a roundup happening right in front of our house. So these things made me realize that it wasn't someone else's story.
Okay.
It had become mine.
Yeah. When Rachel does begin working with the resistance, she begins by doing some fairly easy tasks. She's delivering as a courier, and there's danger in that, but then the stakes get higher. I was wondering if you were able to draw on any experiences of protest or political resistance as you wrote these scenes.
Do you mean in my own experience?
Yes.
Oh, definitely. I was a child of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the peace movement.
Right.
I went to volunteer in Washington at the time of the Cambodian invasion. I also, and I think this is more relevant to this book in a way, I also grew up in the segregated South from the time I was 8. We moved to North Carolina in 1956.
Oh, okay.
And so the moment came when the first black student came into my all-white school when I was in the 7th grade. And I was in the schoolyard waiting to go in for the first time as she was being persecuted and jeered.
Oh, wow.
And so I had that choice, whether I would collude and look away, whether I would collaborate and persecute her as well, or whether I would resist and help her. So I can identify with the dilemmas that people in Amsterdam faced and all the shades of gray and how hard it is to sustain that over time.
Yeah, yeah. In part two of the book, the family has to go into hiding. And at this point, you change the narration. The first part of the book is Rachel's narration. It's in the third person, but it's a very close point of view. And then in the second part of the book, you change to multiple points of view. We get to hear the story from various perspectives. So I wonder if you can talk about making this creative decision.
Yes, it was a difficult decision because I had almost equal numbers of my most trusted advisors who thought it was crazy and I shouldn't do it that way, and people who really liked it. So it was up to me.
Yeah.
Now, there were other choices where the weight of opinion was so strongly on one side that even if I had my doubts, I would usually go with the people I respected because it is my baby, and of course I don't want to cut off one of its toes. but in this case, I held my ground. This was what I preferred to do, and there were three main reasons for it. One was that I thought it would just get too claustrophobic otherwise, that if we had to stay in one mind, in one room, it would just be too excruciating for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
But the second was that I wanted to show that there was more to Rose and Jacob, the parents, than Rachel realized.
Yes.
And that there was a whole side to both of them and to their relationship which had escaped her.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, she is a teenager, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, just barely out of being a teenager by the time the book ends. So she's this gives a balance to the view of them that we've had thus far. And also because I don't want to spoil too much, but because another major character is introduced, I wanted to be able to have that person's story be told from a point of view that revealed the roots of his story. And I didn't think I could do that through Rachel's
through
eyes.
Rachel. Otherwise, you'd have to do it all in dialogue or something.
I tried. It didn't work very well. And then the third reason was that I wanted and interweaving at that point that would account for more than I could account for through the eyes of any young person.
Okay, great. Now, you mentioned that you also write poetry, and you have an MFA in poetry. So can you talk about your approach to poetry versus fiction?
Yes, it is a very different matter. I have never had an attraction to short-form fiction. I don't read it a lot, and I have never written it. But I read novels devotedly and devour them.
Yeah.
So that when this, I first wrote poetry on this theme. That was where I began in 2001. And in fact, it was because I felt that the poetry I was writing was not as well crafted as I wanted it to be. And for the first time, a subject had seized me that I wanted to bring into the world,
yeah,
as opposed to all the writing I had done for family, friends, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there. So that was what impelled me into the MFA program at Vermont College, which was a wonderful thing for me. But when this story began to come to me, I at first was just scribbling bits here, there, and everywhere. The characters began to gel for me somewhat. And then as I read more and more history, went to more and more museum exhibits, and then something I did for many days was searching out sites where important things happened, some of which are marked, many of which are not marked, I began to ask myself, where were my characters that day?
Mm-hmm.
What happened to them that day? So there was a I guess what's parallel between the novel writing and the poetry writing is that there's the moment of inspiration, and then there is all of the hard work that follows. But structuring the novel felt very, very different from structuring a poem. And sustaining that structure over a very,
yeah,
long period. And this novel has been cut substantially. I think the last cut was 20,000 words.
Wow.
So, yeah, so there's a lot that isn't there anymore. That's, and of course, with a poem, you compress too, but this was even more so. There's a story I'd like to tell you.
Sure.
So when we returned to Amsterdam in 2002, we'd been there for the first 6 months of 2001, and then miraculously got invited back the next year. We were living in an apartment in the Prinsengracht, just up from where the Anne Frank House is located. And our landlord was an older man in his 80s who had bought the house maybe 20 years before. So he had not owned it during the war. But one day, he took us up to the attic, which was just above our apartment. He and his wife lived below us, and the attic was overhead. He took us up to show us his office, which was in that space. And I made some innocuous social comment like, oh, it's so nice and bright up here, because he had a lot of windows on all sides. And he said, I replaced the windows up here. And I said, oh. And he said, some people thought I shouldn't.
Hmm.
And I said, why not? And he said, because there were Jewish people hidden in this attic. And there were bullet holes.
Oh.
Where they were seen escaping over the rooftops as the Nazis shot at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to ask, who were they and what brought them here? And this is my answer.
That's very powerful. I want to know, Mary, you said you're a voracious reader of novels.
Mm. Mm.
Have you read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners?
I have a book that is not unrelated to mine by Laurel Corona, The Mapmaker's Daughter.
Oh, okay.
I found fascinating.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it hugely. On the nonfiction side, I recently read The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Oh, that's
and
very
was
good.
Most impressed by it,
yeah.
And recently got to hear Rebecca Skloot speak about it, which was very interesting. I published with She Writes Press.
Yes.
And we had a retreat for the authors in the last few weeks, and she was our keynote speaker. One of my favorite novels, historical novels, not set in this period, but it's a fascinating one, is Amitav Ghosh's Sea of Poppies.
Oh, okay.
Which is during the Opium Wars between India and China, and it is a magnificent rendering of very particular people and dilemmas that illumine a whole time. And I learned a lot
wow.
from reading that.
Those are great suggestions. Thank you. What are you working on now in your writing?
I'm working on essays related to the themes of this book. And I'm certainly asking myself the question you asked earlier, what are the parallels? Where are the places where we can depart from what happened in the Netherlands at this time, and what are the places that are worthy of emulation?
Right.
No, how can we find the courage that Rachel found and that some of the other characters in the book find?
Yeah. It certainly seems so far like there's a great deal of social consciousness and uprising starting to happen in anticipation of what might be coming, right?
Yes, and that's a very positive thing indeed.
Can you talk a little bit about your publishing experience with She Writes Press?
Sure. I probably spent a year and a half, maybe 2 years, doing all the right things to find an agent. I had lots of good advice, and I went to conferences, and I used my network, and I had a really great query letter. And I would say I had three near misses.
Yeah.
But it wasn't happening. And I gave 13 years of my life to this book, and I didn't want to wait any longer.
Yeah.
And I also felt that there was a way in which the chances are so teensy at this point for a debut novelist that I just thought it's time to get on with it. And She Writes had a very good reputation. I had seen their books and admired their books. And it's a kind of middle path between self-publishing at one extreme and traditional publishing at the other, in that they're very picky. They only take, I think it's 7% of manuscripts. The books look wonderful. They're extremely well designed. They get distributed by the same distributor as the Big Five, so that's very helpful. And you have a group of women who want to help each other.
Yeah.
And that, nearly everything I've ever accomplished has been accomplished partly with the help of other people and especially women. And that was part of my reason for wanting to be there, especially because one of my motives with this book was to show what ordinary women did in the underground.
Yeah.
Because these messenger or courier jobs were not easy. They were very risky, especially as Rachel escalates
yes.
through the hierarchy of, you know, from the messages that can be coded and therefore can be interpreted in an okay way, then the underground newspapers, and then the identity papers, which are much, much more dangerous.
Right, right. Your cover is wonderful. And I
Thank
saw
you.
That Julie Metz designed your cover. She's
yes.
actually been on the show.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, because she wrote a memoir. I don't know
she
if you
did.
Know her
I've read
story.
It.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so is she working with She Writes? Or
yes.
She is, okay.
Yes, she does almost all the covers, if not all.
Now, when you were with She Writes, you had an editor? Do you have a publicist? How does that work?
I actually had already had the book edited before I got to She Writes.
Okay.
And I worked with Amy Belding Brown, who's the author of Emerson's Wife, among several other excellent historical novels.
Oh, okay.
So I had somebody who wrote serious historical fiction, and that was extremely helpful to me.
All right.
And that was in addition to all of my writing groups, readers. I had a plethora of people involved by the time it was done. And I hired a publicist separately, but still in the same consortium seems like a big word, but that's what it really is with
okay.
She Writes.
All right. Now, I want to just finish up with a question. I like to ask people to offer advice. Mm. So I wonder if you have any advice for writers who are working on historical fiction. I know that's kind of a broad topic, but is there anything you wish you had known when you began?
I understood when I began the importance of accuracy.
Uh-huh.
And I went to great pains to make the book as accurate as I could. I was very lucky, to find Dr. Loreen Nussbaum, who was a friend and contemporary of Margot Frank's, who reviewed the whole book not once but twice,
wow.
Which was really kind of her. And she's a scholar of this period as well as having lived through it. So that gave me a certain confidence that all of the book learning that I had had paid off. Thank you. So I think I understood that part. What I felt very insecure about was where it was okay for me to invent or fill in the blanks. And I remember the exact moment when I learned to trust myself. I was in the Netherlands World War II Institute in Amsterdam. It's now been renamed, but that's what it was called then. I was in the library, and I was looking at a machine that, not a computer yet, but a machine that was showing me photographs, and it showed a picture of a tree that it had all of the limbs hacked off, just the trunk was left. And I said, oh, that must have been in the Hunger Winter, which was after this book ends, the winter of 1944 to 45. There were more than 2,000 deaths by starvation in Amsterdam alone. And it was a bitterly cold winter, and the Germans had cut off the fuel. So that people literally hacked the limbs off the trees to burn them. They took up the wooden parts of the rails in the trams, and they broke into the houses of the deported Jewish people and burned the furniture.
Wow.
A time of absolute desperation. But the fact that when I saw that photograph, I knew, told me that I had taken in enough of all of these, I'd steeped myself enough in all of these facts and conversations and images that place and time was real enough to me that I could begin to say, yeah, it was this way, or no, it couldn't have been that way. And that, when I achieved that level of digested information, then I was able to go back at some of my early drafts and edit them very quickly, because I could see what was there and what wasn't there.
Yeah. So there was a point where you learned to trust yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to just say again that the title is An Address in Amsterdam, a novel by Mary Dingy Fillmore, published by She Writes Press. Thank you so much, Mary. This was great.
Thank you so much for doing this with me and for all that you do for writers, of which this is only one aspect.
Thank you, Mary. That, again, was a conversation with Mary Dingy Fillmore. You can learn more about her work at the websites maryfillmore.com and seehiddenamsterdam.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Mary Dingy Fillmore, who says that when she is stuck in her writing, she likes to describe the environment, the weather, the shadows in the snow, or the shadows in the grass. Anything along those lines nearly always works to get her going again. Good luck with your own work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.